Prabhupada. All glories to the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. All glories to the International Seminar for Higher Vaishnava Education. And all glories to the participants to the seminar.
All glories to the speaker.
So, today we are going to discuss on Shat Darshan. The Vedic philosophy has been divided into six different branches, and they are known as Shat Darshan, or six branches of philosophy. This is a combination of two words, Shat and Darshan. Now this T, when it appears before D, in conjunction, the T becomes D. So, when it becomes one word, then it becomes Shat Darshan. So, these six branches of philosophies are Purva Mimamsa, Naya, Vaisheshika, Shankha, Yoga, and Uttar Mimamsa. Now, the Vedas have been basically divided into three khandas or three groups. Vedic wisdom has been divided into three groups or three branches, and those three branches are known as Karma Khanda, Jnana Khanda, and Upasana Khanda. And the philosophy is describing those three khandas or elaborating those three khandas are known as the sixth darshan. Now, the Karma Khanda section of the Vedas have been explained by the Karma Mimamsa or Purva Mimamsa. The word Purva means preliminary, and Mimamsa means conclusion. So, the Purva Mimamsa branch of philosophy is the preliminary conclusion of the Vedic approach. That's a mistake actually. It shouldn't be Purna, but Purva. Instead of N, it will be V. And there's another mention of that word afterwards, so that will be correct. So this Purva Mimamsa branch of philosophy is dealing with the Karma Khanda section. And the Karma Khanda section, the conclusion of this philosophy is that good action or good karma leads to enjoyment and bad karma leads to suffering. So since everybody wants to enjoy, everybody must always be involved in good action. And that is the Purva Mimamsa or Karma Mimamsa. The karma, the activities is the cause of one's suffering or enjoyment. And good activities lead to enjoyment and bad activities lead to suffering. That is the basic understanding or basic conclusion of the Purva Mimamsa. So, always do good action. And what is the good action? Good action means acting according to the Vedic injunction. And bad action means to defy the Vedic injunction. And that is the simple understanding of good and bad activity. Now, if somebody wants to enjoy, then he has been directed that act according to the Vedas. Perform sacrifices and be involved in pleasing the demigods and ultimately pleasing Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But actually in Karma Khanda section, Krishna's identity has not been very elaborately revealed. Now here I also mentioned one thing, that apparently these five branches, the first five branches of philosophy appear to be atheistic. Because in these five branches of philosophy, Krishna's position hasn't been clearly defined. So that's why the tendency is to somehow or other disregard or not consider the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And later on, these branches, at least the four of these five branches of philosophies, have been presented by some atheistic philosophers, and it has become atheistic, but actually, in the Vedas, there is no room for atheism. Vedasya sarvai rahameva vedda, Krishna explained, the purpose of the Vedas is to reveal his identity. So, in the Vedas, there cannot be any room for atheism. It is later on that some atheistic people gave their own interpretation and turned it into a branch of atheistic philosophy. But actually, they are a gradual progression towards the ultimate goal of Krishna consciousness. Like in the beginning, a man is naturally in his bodily platform. Basically, everybody is in the bodily platform. So, and in the bodily platform, people want to enjoy. Meaning, they want to get sense gratification for their enjoyment. So, the instruction has been given. You want to enjoy? Fine. Act according to the Vedic injunction. And what are the enjoyments in the material platform? The enjoyment in the material platform means having the desires fulfilled. In the material platform, we always want the objects of our sense gratification. And when we get the objects, then we feel that now we are happy. Now we are enjoying. So, Purva Mimamsa, the Karmakanda section of the Vedas, are giving a man that facility. You want to be very rich? Okay, perform these sacrifices or act like this. It is something like, you want to become an engineer? Okay, go to the university and study. You want to be a doctor? You go to the medical school and study, and then you learn the subject. So that is the basic understanding of the Karmakanda. If you want to accomplish something, then you have to follow a specific course. And you want to become rich, so follow this course. You want to have beautiful woman as your wife, you follow this course. You want to become the king of the entire earth planet, perform such and such sacrifices. You want to be elevated to the heavenly planets, there are specific performances. But they are all pertaining to the body. They all are pertaining to sense enjoyment. So then, in spite of making so many endeavors for enjoyment when somebody does not enjoy, like in the material platform, no matter whatever position we acquire, no matter how much facilities we get for our sense enjoyment, but still, in the material platform, we cannot be fully satisfied, we cannot be happy, we cannot be joyful. So a thoughtful person will consider, I do not want to suffer, I want to enjoy. And for the sake of my enjoyment, I am making so many endeavors. I am trying in so many different ways to enjoy, but still, why am I suffering? So that is the time when one transcends the Karmakanda section. And this, why am I suffering, is the first step to the Gyanakanda. Transcending Karmakanda, they are coming to the Gyanakanda section. The why, this inquiry is the stepping stone to the Gyanakanda section. And that begins, the answer to that why comes, or the endeavor to get the answer for this why am I suffering, comes through the through the logic. Like, why am I suffering? You have to analyze the reason why you are suffering. And that is known as naya. The Sanskrit, the literal English translation of the Sanskrit word naya is logic. And the conclusion is, or the derivatives from that approach of naya ultimately is that why am I suffering? They analyze 21 different causes of suffering. And those causes, the first cause they consider is the body. I have this body and that's why I am suffering. The Buddhists actually take that aspect of naya, and the whole Buddhistic philosophy is based on it. The body is the cause of suffering. So since we don't want to suffer, get rid of the body. But this Naya branch of philosophy goes more deep into it and did not really end in the Naya itself. That's the most wonderful aspect of the Vedic philosophy. It transcends one platform to the other platform. When it comes to an end, then it actually transcends to the next one. Like often we hear, it is analyzed like, when science ends, philosophy begins. And when philosophy ends, religion begins. So this way we can see that knowledge actually, if it is pursued in the right direction, then it takes us from higher to the higher platform. And if we are following the right track under the right direction, then we will come to the ultimate conclusion. So, in the Naya philosophy, they consider that there are different reasons for suffering. The first reason is the body. We have this body, that's why we are suffering. The question may arise, how can you conclude that because we have the body, we are suffering? The answer can be given, like you take any part of your body. Take, say, for your finger. Take your finger, consider your finger. And consider in how many different ways you can give pain to your finger. Right? You can burn it, get a lot of pain. You can take a stone and smash it. How will you feel? You can take a knife, you can cut it. You can consider in how many different ways you can give pain to your finger. But now you consider in how many different ways you can give pleasure to your finger. How many? Can anyone think of any way to give pleasure to your finger? So that shows that, and that principle can actually apply to any part of our body. Well, that's true. When you come to the japa platform, then you have transcended all the material platforms. So then you are in a blissful state. So that principle actually applies to every part of our body, that any part of our body can receive pain in unlimited ways, but it cannot receive pleasure by any means. Like the pleasure is so insignificant compared to the degree of pain that you can receive. So that's why when we apply that principle to the entire body, then the conclusion is that this body is actually designed for suffering. This body is actually a wonderful instrument to receive pain. And then they consider that there are six different senses, and they are also the causes of pain, like eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and touch. These are the five external senses, and there is one internal sense. That is the mind. And then the objects of the senses are also the causes of pain, causes of suffering. And then there are six kinds of growth. One grows beautiful. And more he grows in that direction, more attached he becomes to the material nature. And to that degree, he suffers. One grows rich. And you see, like all these growths, growth in beauty, growth in wealth, growth in strength, growth in fame. So these are all the causes of our material attachments. And more it grows, the more we grow towards that direction, the greater becomes the degree of our suffering. So 3 sixes are 18 plus 1, 19, body. And then they consider that happiness is also the cause of pain. The concept of happiness is there, that's why the concept of pain is there. So happiness also is the cause of pain, and then pain itself is the cause of pain. So this way they analyze the 21 different causes of suffering. So, and then ultimately they conclude that this material nature is a place for suffering. No one actually comes to the material nature to enjoy. The way a person doesn't go to the prison house to enjoy, only a fool will think that he'll go to the prison and enjoy. The same way, no sane person comes to the material nature to enjoy. Everyone actually comes here to suffer. So then they consider, then what is the material nature? And that, then at that point, they are transcending the Naya platform and they are coming to the Vaisheshika platform. Now what is this material nature? Let us consider what this material nature is. Their approach would be, let us take any object, what this actually is. Material nature is a combination of different objects. Now let us take an object. What is the object? So let's take this wall. And what is this wall actually? Now this wall is a combination of bricks and cement and some paint on the surface. Now what are these bricks? What are those cements? What are these paints? Like, when they analyze further and further and further, they come to the ultimate point that this everything is actually produced out of atoms. The bricks are produced out of atoms, the cement is produced out of atoms, the paint is produced out of atoms. So everything in the material nature, all the objects are actually composed of atoms. So Vaisheshika philosophy actually leads to that understanding that this whole creation is composed of paramanus or atoms. But at according to the different frequency of these minutest particles called paramanu, and their impression on our senses create the impression of different objects of the senses. But if we conceive it intellectually, philosophy is actually an intellectual perception. The Sanskrit word for philosophy is darshan. Darshan literally means to see. Now, sometimes we see with our eyes, and sometimes we see with our mind, and sometimes we see with our intellect. So philosophy or darshan is actually the perception with our intellect. Now, if we intellectually perceive the creation, then through Vaisheshika darshan, we'll perceive this creation as a combination of atoms everywhere. The air is filled with atoms, the solid substances are filled with atoms, the water is filled with atoms. So the whole creation is filled with atoms. And atoms means here paramanu. The Vedic concept of atom or paramanu is not exactly the modern scientific concept of atom. They're even more definite and more subtle. According to the Vedic understanding, paramanu means the minutest particle. Now, atoms are not the minutest particle. The atoms are actually the combination of the neutron and proton and electrons. The nucleus and the electrons, and they are found different other charges also, positrons and so this way we can see that the atoms are not actually the minutest particles. So the paramanu that the Vedas are talking about are not exactly the atoms of the modern scientific concept. Anyway, the understanding is that the whole thing, the whole creation is made of atoms or minutest particles. So that is the Vaisheshika philosophy. Then they get into that, let us consider what this whole creation is about, what it is composed of. So from Vaisheshika, they come to the platform of Shankha, or analytical study of the material nature. And through this analytical study of the material nature, they define the material nature with 24 material considerations in Shankha philosophy. What are those 24 material considerations? They are 5 senses, 5 elements of the material nature, 5 objects of the senses, and 5 working senses, then 3 subtle elements, and then Mahatattva, the basic ingredient for material creation. Now, is there any need to elaborate that on that, like 5 elements, 5 senses, 5 working senses, and 5 objects of the senses? I'm sure everybody knows about that. Right? So these are 4 fives are 20, and 3 subtle elements, 23, and then Mahatattva, 24. So with these 24 considerations, they analyze the whole material creation. But then, actually the atheistic Sankha stops there. The materialistic Shankara approach stops there. But actually the Vedic, the real Vaishnava approach doesn't stop there in 24 different configurations. They even go further and they say that all these 24 elements or all these 24 configurations are objective in nature. They are objective. But objects cannot exist without the subject. And now what is the subject? And the subject is I. I am here, that's why the material nature is manifest. If I am not here, then this nature will not be manifest to me. Now everybody has an I. And because of that I, this objective nature is manifest. So that I in Sanskrit is Atma. In Sanskrit, Atma means actually I. And then they consider that the entire material nature has been defined by 24 considerations. But nowhere could we find the I. So this I does not belong to the material nature. The I belongs to the non-material nature, hence I is spiritual. And then they further considered that there are these I's are minute and many. Everybody has an I. And so these eyes are many and these eyes are minute. Now anything that is minute and many must have an origin, a source. So what is the source of these minute eyes? The supreme I or the super soul or param atma. So ultimately, Naya branch of philosophy is taking us from the atheistic platform or non-believing platform to the believing platform. But through science, through this branch of philosophy, it has been described or it has been clearly defined that the spiritual nature does exist. And then the question comes, then if the I, which is a part of the supreme I, then what is the relationship between the I and the supreme I? What is the relationship between the super soul and the spirit soul? And that establishing that relationship is the yoga branch of philosophy, or the fifth branch of Vedic philosophy. That fifth branch of Vedic philosophy begins with the consideration that we have become, the I has become impure. And that's why the I or Atma has become isolated from the super soul or Paramatma. Now, because of its impurity, the Atma has become isolated from the Paramatma. Now, if the Atma wants to be linked up with the Paramatma, then Atma must become purified. So the yoga begins with the process of purification. The first is a branch called yam or external purification. Now external purification does not only involve taking bath and wearing clean clothes. The external purification involves also eating pure food, because whatever we eat, that is transformed into our body. Our body is made from the food we eat. Now, if we eat impure food, then our body also will become impure. So the instruction is that eat always pure food. And in the highest understanding, the pure food means the food that has been offered to Krishna. Again, I'll repeat that you see, the followers of the Vedic principle did not have the slightest doubt about Krishna and how to follow the Vedas and how to purify one's habits and so on and so forth. Like all these atheistic approaches or atheistic considerations started very recently after the Kali Yuga began. In the past also there were some branches of philosophy, philosophers, but they are never taken seriously. some atheistic philosophers like Charvaka. Anyway, we don't have any reason to get into Charvaka philosophy right now. We are dealing with another aspect of Vedic philosophy. So, those days, the followers of the Vedic principles knew that purity of food meant the food that has been offered to Krishna. Because in Gita, Krishna has very, very clearly mentioned that. That those who eat, those who cook for themselves, they simply eat their sins. So that's why everything should be offered to me for the sake of purification. So that is how, by this conclusion that one must eat pure food to have a pure body, was understood by everyone, those who are following the Vedic culture. Then the second branch of the second step of the yoga philosophy is niyam, or internal purification. Yes, the body has been purified by keeping it clean, by developing clean habits, by eating clean food, and so on and so forth. But what about internal purification? For the internal purifications, the prescriptions have been given. To purify your inside, you have to be truthful. To purify your inside, you have to be merciful. To purify your inside, you should be compassionate. So these are the instructions for internal purification. Then comes the third stage of this yoga philosophy, that is called asana. Now asana, the word asana literally means a seat. The understanding is, this body is a machine. Now if you want to ride a machine, what do you do first? You have to sit down. So we have to sit in our body properly to drive the machine properly. And this human body is actually a very wonderful vehicle, a very nice machine to reach our ultimate destination. And what is that ultimate destination? The ultimate destination is the spiritual sky beyond this material nature. And that goal can be reached only by this human body, only through this human body. So that's why it has been instructed that human body should be used or driven very carefully. And to drive it properly, we have to sit down properly. So asana is the practice to use the body properly to reach the ultimate destination. Then the fourth stage is called pranayama. And pranayama means breathing control. Prana means life air. And pranayama means the controlling of the life air. So this basically, it's a very, very elaborate process, but basically there are three practices, or three practices we can say. Like one is, our breathing has got three aspects, right? And those three aspects are inhaling, exhaling, and retaining. When we breathe, we inhale, and then we retain it in our lungs or in our body, the life air. And then we exhale it, we give it out. So the inhaling process is known as puraka. And retaining process is known as kumbhaka. And exhaling process is known as rechaka. Now, what they do in this practice, it is actually an internal breathing exercise. Like they gradually decrease the period of inhaling and exhaling and increase the period of kumbhaka. And a yogi, ultimately what he does, he literally stops breathing. Stops breathing means he stops inhaling and exhaling, but he retains it inside through the process of kumbhaka. Also, it has been described that everybody's number of breath is limited. Everybody actually has been assigned to breathe a certain number of breaths, right? So nowadays we see people are jogging or people exhaust themselves very much to, in order to get a good health. But actually they do not know that they are actually reducing their lifespan. Because when they get tired, they breathe very heavily, right? Very, very quick. And then that actually minimizes their lifespan. So a yogi, what he does, say he has, say 1 million breaths to take, right? And he takes, say, 1 breath a year. He stops the process practically, and he takes 1 breath a year, and that's how he is able to survive for 1 million years. So that's what the pranayama process does. It stops the process of inhaling and exhaling and retains the life air inside. There is also further consideration that the life, this prana or the life air are actually causing, the soul is sustained, suspended in 5 kinds of air in the body. They are known as pran, apan, shaman, vyan and udan. So there are 5 different kinds of air, and the spirit soul is suspended on those airs. And when there is some imbalance or discord in the harmony of the airs, that causes the agitation to the spirit soul. And that's why, due to the agitation, the spirit soul becomes attached to the material nature, vice versa. As the spirit soul becomes attached to the material nature, his air becomes agitated. So, we can practically consider one example. When the people, those who are very detached, they are very peaceful. But the people, those who are very attached, they are very agitated. So we can see that it is the agitation that causes our attachment to the material nature. And if we want to become detached from material nature, then we have to become very peaceful. And the spirit can become peaceful only when the air, the life air, is in equilibrium. So the pranayama is the process that brings that equilibrium. And when we are, also another consideration, how our breathing is linked with our agitation also. Like a person who is very agitated, he breathes very fast. You must have noticed that. When you become agitated, your breathing becomes faster. But when you are peaceful, your breathing is slower. So can you consider if a person who has become, who has practically breathing, who is breathing very, very slowly, he must be very, very peaceful. He automatically becomes very peaceful. And the yogis, they make it so, they make their breathing process so slow that it seems that they literally stopped to breathe. A very interesting aspect of the yoga philosophy, this pranayama. And the yogis actually attain a lot of mystic power through this pranayama process. So then, after one has mastered the pranayama process, when one has controlled his breathing and has brought a very wonderful harmony in the life air, in his life air, then he becomes eligible, or then he becomes able to withdraw his senses from the objects of the senses. And that withdrawal of the senses from the objects of the senses, that process is known as pratyahara. That is the 5th aspect of yoga philosophy. Pratyahara. Pratyahara literally means withdrawal. The senses are constantly running towards the objects of the senses. Dhayate vishayan pumsha. The senses are constantly running towards the objects of the senses. But a yogi withdraws his senses from the objects of the senses. And that's possible only when one has properly mastered the art of pranayama. We can see that to some extent we can do that also. Like when you become thoughtful of something, when you become very thoughtful, then there may be some object in front of our eyes, and our eyes may be open, but we do not see that object. When you are thinking very deeply about something, then there may be some sound, and we do not register that sound. So we can see that that is possible by withdrawing our consciousness inwardly. It is possible to detach our senses from the objects of the senses. So that is the fifth aspect of the yoga, Ashtanga yoga. Then the sixth one is called dhyana or meditation. After they have withdrawn the senses from the objects of the senses, then they focus their consciousness internally into the core of their heart, where the super soul, Paramatma, is sitting. Dhyana literally means meditating on the super soul. Meditating or fixing your mind on some material objects is not actually the dhyana or meditation in its true sense. Actually, everyone in the material platform is meditating. Like as I mentioned, dhyate vishayan punsha. Everyone is meditating, but what they're meditating on? They're meditating on vishaya, objects of the senses. They're meditating on their sense gratification. They're meditating on the objects of the sense gratification. They're meditating on money. They're meditating on so many different material objects. So everyone is constantly meditating. But unfortunately, they are meditating on the wrong objects. But the meditation, according to the yoga philosophy, is the meditation of the super soul who is sitting in the depth of our heart. Then, when the projection of our consciousness on the super soul becomes fixed up, then that stage is called dharana, or fixing up. That's the seventh stage. And when our consciousness is fixed on the super soul, then a reciprocation begins between the spirit soul and super soul. Or perceiving the beauty of the super soul and the grandeur of the super soul, the living entity becomes absolutely overwhelmed. At that time he doesn't have any more consideration for anything else externally. He is completely withdrawn internally. And that is the stage of samadhi or trance. So this is the fifth branch of Vedic philosophy. And then, let us consider, when a spirit soul perceives the super soul, then what happens? The spirit soul is minute and the super soul is absolute. Now when a small person comes across a very great person, how does he feel? What does he do? If you come across someone very great, how will you feel? You'll feel humble. Your head will bend down in surrender. So that's what happens when the spirit soul perceives the super soul. Then he surrenders himself to the super soul. And that surrender is called sharanagati or prapatti. And this sharanagati or prapatti is the beginning of devotion. Devotional service to the Lord is founded on this surrender to the super soul. So that's why Prabhupada mentioned that devotion begins after one becomes perfect in yoga. So this is how we can understand that the platform of devotional service is transcendental to the platform of yoga perfection. Because by attaining the perfection of yoga, one comes to the understanding that he must surrender himself to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that is the sixth branch of the Vedic philosophy called Uttar Mimamsa, or final conclusion. The final conclusion is the living entities are the minute parts and parcels of the Supreme Personality of Godhead or Super Soul. And being a part and parcel, the living entity must be connected to the Super Soul. And the way to be connected to the Super Soul or the Supreme Personality of Godhead is by rendering positive service towards Him, because it's the duty of the part to render service unto the whole. A leaf of a tree, no matter how insignificant that leaf is, the leaf as a part of the tree, its duty is to render some service unto the tree. And as long as the leaf renders that service unto the tree, like transforming energy, food into energy with the rays of sun, that's what the function of the leaf is. As long as it does that function, then the leaf is connected to the tree. But as soon as the leaf stops to perform that function, what happens? The leaf falls out of the tree. So, the living entity, being a part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, must be connected to the Lord by means of service. And if it doesn't render that service, then it becomes isolated from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, these are the six branches of Vedic philosophies from Purva Mimamsa, from preliminary conclusion of good action and bad action, enjoyment of the body, to they ultimately come to the final conclusion through different configuration. And this final conclusion or Uttar Mimamsa is the branch of the philosophy that describes the Upasana Kanda. And there are different ways of rendering Upasana to the Lord according to different ages. In Satya Yuga, the method of Upasana is meditation. In Treta Yuga, the way of Upasana is by performing sacrifice. In Dwapar Yuga, the way of Upasana is to worship the Lord in the temple. And in Kali Yuga, the way to render Upasana to the Lord is by chanting the holy name of the Lord. So actually, when we take a methodical approach of the Vedic philosophy, then this way we ultimately come to the platform of devotional service. And in this age, it is the congregational chanting or the Sankirtan. Now, although apparently it may seem that we are blindly following the instruction given by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Prabhupada, but actually we can say, although we are blindly following Srila Prabhupada's instruction, but Prabhupada, we may be following it blindly, but Prabhupada is not blind. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is not blind. They have derived the ultimate conclusions of the Vedas and presented it to us for the conditioned living entities in the age of Kali. That's why in our prayers to the six Goswamis we sing, the Nana Shastra Vicharinaiko Nipuno Shadharma Sangsthapako Lokanam Hitokarino Tribhuvane Manno Sarannakaro. Nana Shastra Vicharina Eko Nipuno. Very expertly they have analyzed different scriptures and they have established the Sadharma, the real eternal religion of the living entities for the sake of the conditioned living entities. Lokanam hitakarino, for the benefit of the conditioned living entities. And that's why they are tribhuvane manno sarannakaro. That's why they are worshipped in the three worlds with great respect and reverence. We can see that how fortunate we are to be in this International Society for Krishna Consciousness, where we have the final conclusion of the entire Vedic wisdom, and we have received it so easily. We are not very qualified, we are not very intelligent. But by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy, we have received this most wonderful conclusion, and we are practicing that. And by practicing, we are positively going to derive the ultimate benefit of our life.
Katkarya and progressive. So, where is the word or the concept of sadarshan to be found in the Vedic tradition?
You see, there is a book called Nirukti. That's the Vedic dictionary. So, these words, first of all, it's mentioned there. Nirukti describes, not only there are Shaddarshan, there is Sharanga. Veda has six angas, or six limbs. And those six limbs are Shikha, Kalpa, Shabda, Nirukti, Vyakaran, and Jyotish. So these are the Sharanga, Shaddarshan, three Khandas, and Ashtanga Yoga. So these are all there. All these concepts are coming from the Vedic concept. If somebody asks us where a certain word comes from, then we have to refer to the dictionary. They're actually defined in dictionary. But the wonderful thing about the Vedic Nirukti is that it is understood that the words came first. The words came first, then came the object. The thing is, it's a transformation of spiritual energy into material energy. And in the material nature, the subtlest of the element is ether. Right? And sound is from the ether. So when Brahma was transforming, it first transformed into sound. And also in Christianity also we have the same concept. In the beginning there was sound. And then from sound the form came. From sound came the feel. From the feel came the form. And it further goes on. That is because we are approaching from the other end, right? We are approaching from the material end. That's why first we have the object and then we have the name. But when you make an approach from the spiritual end, spiritual side, then first there is the name and then there is the object. Chandamsi jasya patrani jastam veda sa veda veda.
Krishna creates first things, then
it's created. Yeah, you can say that. It's an objective nature. This is the nature of impression. It's, the impressions become reality. Like in a dream, the real thing is not there, but the impression of the reality is there, and that is projected as reality. That's why it's a dream. Now this material nature is a reflection of the spiritual nature, right? The impressions of the spiritual nature is manifested here as the material reality.
That was my next question actually, to understand our position of the statements of the karmis who are approaching, they're defining, they're commenting also on the sadarshans, explaining that those were later commentaries and interpretations of the Vedic knowledge, like for instance the yoga system of Patanjali is known, or at least is proposed to have been expounded quite recently. So is that our...
there are four Vaishnava Sampradayas, right? Now, recently we find that Ramanujacharya came, Madhvacharya came, Nimbarka Swami came and Vishnu Swami came. Now, apparently it seems that they actually established this, they actually propounded these four branches of Vaishnavism. But actually they are not, they simply enhanced it, right? The original propounders are Lakshmi Devi, Brahma, four Kumaras and Lord Shiva. So these, Jaimini, Gautam, Patanjali of course is not an atheistic. Patanjali's yoga is not atheistic. He is his theistic. But other four, they are actually atheistic.
Even Jaimini?
Yes, Jaimini is also atheist.
But he was disciple yesterday.
You see, Vasudev's line has the two lines. Two lines. One is the materialistic line, and the other is the spiritual line. He actually gave two successions. Like one line is from the sages, right? They are the Brahmavadis. Atheistic in the sense they are mostly Brahmavadis. And the theistic line of Brahma is coming from Narada. And we actually belong to that sampradaya. You see, Brahma gave the knowledge to his 9 sons, right? And Narada was withdrawn. He didn't want to get involved, right? And he actually thought that, you know, this material nature is Maya, and I don't want to get involved in it. But then, one day Narada saw Brahma. He was in a trance, and tears were streaming down his eyes, and all kinds of ecstatic symptoms were manifest in his body. So Narada asked Brahma, My dear father, all this while I used to think that you are the Supreme. But thinking upon whom, meditating upon whom, you experience such ecstasy. So then Brahma revealed to Narada the knowledge about Krishna. So that is another branch, that is the theistic, I mean real Vaishnava branch of our line is coming that way. But the other branches, you know, like if you take, even if you take, you know, Atri, Angira, Marichi, there is, you know, like, there is a great influence of impersonalism. Because, you know, like, and their main projection is that how to manifest, actually those Prajapati, their main business is to help Brahma create. And so they got involved in the material nature very much. And their whole projection, actually Brahma gave the Vedas, that's one branch of the Vedas. And the other branch is the pure devotional branch of the Vedas. So that's why sometimes, you know, there is a, actually why in India there is so much confusion. It's because of this, you know, like in one side you see so many, you know, stalwart sages, right? And they are giving their conclusions and you can't just often say that they are bogus, right? People will get very angry if you say that. So that's why actually he, also in Mahabharata it has been clearly defined that Mahajana Jana Gatashrapana, follow the footsteps of the Mahajana. And Mahabharata actually described in that particular shloka that do not get entangled with the conclusions of the sages. Tarko apratishta srutaya vibhinna, naso rishi jasya matanna bhinna. The different sages have got their different conclusions, so don't get entangled in that because it will simply confuse you. So dharmasya tattam nihitam guhayam, the secret of dharma is hidden in the hearts of the devotees. So simply follow their footsteps.
So if I may ask, what is your definition of how should we understand atheistic? Because I understand that the disciples of yesterday, like in the Upanishad, there is explanation that one should act for the Guru in order to have a better life in next life. In other words, there's understanding that there's a soul remaining after the disappearance of the body, and that the soul should use the body in order to perform various activities to get benefits. So there's understanding of the soul, there's understanding of reincarnation.
Yeah, but so they're accepting the soul. Actually, the whole Vedic philosophy, even the Charvaka, you know, like accepting the Charvaka, all the Vedic branches, Vedic philosophers accept the existence of the soul. But the problem is that they ultimately conclude that the ultimate destination of soul is Brahman.
Is Brahman?
Brahman. Soul is coming from the Brahman, and when the soul gets involved in the material nature, there is this variety which is the cause of suffering and enjoyment. So, in order to get out of that duality of suffering and enjoyment, one must be situated in the Santa platform or Brahma Buddha platform. Yeah.
In this connection, I need to explain a little how Brahma Harshan was also entrusted with one section of the Vedas. And yet, and of course, he was so respected for his being a sage, he was elected as the head of the council by the Shaino to speak as the spiritual master. But of course, Lord Balaram came and said, this person is not qualified to speak.
Yeah.
And he killed him.
Yeah. Yeah, like, he didn't show respect to Balaram. And that's why Balaram just finished him with just a blade of grass. Touched him with a blade of grass and finished. So the thing is, they may have a lot of knowledge, but if they are not respectful towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead, doesn't accept His supremacy, then they become finished.
So, I'm trying to also relate at this point, so, and also the conclusion of the Sadharma, which of course is given by his personality, Mahajan, Sri Prabhupada. So, how do we relate this? Because on one hand, what we're talking is a progression, and on the other hand, that progression is automatically achieved by accepting
Mahajan.
So you can explain this interrelationship.
Interrelationship, actually, we do not really have to, gradually elevate from Karmakanda to Gyanakanda to Upasanakanda. Like in other ages, their duration of life, the lifespan was so vast that in one life they could, transcend from one to the other platform. From Karmakanda they could come to the Gyanakanda. From Gyanakanda they could come to the Upasanakanda and attain the ultimate perfection, right? But in the age of Kali, the people became so short-lived, their intelligence became totally devastated, right? And on top of that, they're constantly troubled by the material nature, so they lost all qualification. That's why the sages in the Naimisharanya present the Sutta Goswami. In one hand, they say that Kali Doshe, Prayan alpayusha shobha palavasthi yuge jana mando sumando matayo mando bhagrahi upadita. What's going to happen to these people? Their lifespan is so short. Their memory is short. Their intelligence is devastated. And on top of everything, they're constantly being troubled by the material nature. So what's going to happen to them? And then the next look, they're saying, bhurini bhuri karmani shrotambani vibhavashana. The Vedas are vast. And, innumerable activities have been prescribed, and unless and until one comes to the total understanding of the Vedas in the totality, cannot come to the ultimate conclusion. So what's going to happen to these people, and how they are going to attain the ultimate goal of their life? And that's why Mahaprabhu came, and you see, previously it was actually an ascending process. Gradually, from a mode of ignorance, to mode of passion, to mode of goodness. And that's why in the early Vedic society, they were so close, they were so particular about the Varnashram Dharma. And the Varnas were very specifically described or practiced. And because it was a gradually ascending process. But Mahaprabhu came and he reversed the cycle. Now when we become totally incapable of elevating ourselves to this transcendental platform, the transcendence came down and in order to pick us up. It's like, it has been described like, when the children are self-sufficient, then the parents are not really so much concerned about them. But the child, who is completely incapable, and the parents are, parents have their greatest concern for him. Like a child who cannot stand up, they come and pick up the child on their lap. So Krishna, our Supreme Father, is doing that. Those who are qualified, in other ages people are qualified. So Krishna gave him, okay, fine, you are capable, so you shall find your own way, or you practice it yourself. But in this age of Kali, we all have become so unqualified that Krishna's mercy has come down to pick us up. So we do not really need to, actually we do not really need to make any kind of gradual progression. We do not need to follow the yoga process. We do not need to follow any branches of the philosophy. Because we have got the ultimate product, the fruit. So why waste our time? But still we consider these things for the sake of teaching. When somebody comes, we have the tool to smash him.
This six branches of philosophy should be considered the lowest step of philosophies, or is it just different steps towards the ultimate conclusion?
Yeah. No, it is one philosophy, six different stages. Because ultimately the Vedas is one topic, right? Understanding Krishna. But according to the ability of different people, they'll make their approach. Some people, those who are into the bodily platform, they will want to enjoy. Somebody, those who are in the intellectual platform, they will try to analyze things and find out, you know, what is what. That's why we can see that out of the six branches of philosophy, one branch actually covers the karma kanda, and one branch covers the upasana kanda. But the four branches out of six covers the jnana kanda. The jnana kanda is the intellectual platform, and you know, they have, you know, whole lot of elaborate intellectual conclusions.
You described nyaya as finding out that there are so many causes of suffering, 21 causes. Is that the same nyaya which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu studied when he was in his young days? Is that all he was concerned with?
But what Mahaprabhu was studying, that is the art of, I mean, Mahaprabhu was an expert in the art of arguments. So nyaya has actually one aspect, which is the logic means, you know, logic means correlating between ideas, right?
Yes.
And so the arguments are, you know, like, you know, correlating about ideas in order to disprove somebody's statement. And that's what Mahaprabhu was very expert about. He would prove everybody wrong. He would turn the right upside down and make prove the right to be wrong. Like, he was so expert that he could even prove by logic that sun actually doesn't rise on the east, it rises on the west. And Mahaprabhu was so, he was such a threat to all the scholars in Navadvip that when they would see Mahaprabhu coming, they would run to the other side of the road to avoid him. And even Srivast Thakur used to avoid him in the morning. Now one day Srivast Thakur was coming after taking his bath on the Ganges, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu saw him on the way. And Srivast Thakur saw Chaitanya Mahaprabhu coming. So he avoided that road and took some other road. And he was avoiding him. So Mahaprabhu caught him and said, "Why are you avoiding me?" So he says, "Whenever I see you, you just bring out all this kind of, all these arguments, and you unnecessarily get into waste your time and just word jugglery and argument." Then, and he said that understand that the ultimate goal of vidya, ultimate goal of knowledge, is to develop devotion to Krishna. Then Mahaprabhu replied, "If you bless me, then maybe someday I will develop that." Mahaprabhu, in his, yeah, before he went to Gaya, he was a great logician. And he actually had such wonderful treatise of logic that the other one great logician, he admitted to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that actually I wrote many things, but they won't be of any use, because compared to what you have given, and they're all useless. So Mahaprabhu took all his writings and threw them in the Ganges.
So actually this logic is the basis of development, the arguments, what has been used in the Vedanta Sutra also. That is called, Srila Prabhupada uses those definitions in the Shrivaivata and explaining the way Vedanta Sutra has been developed through different steps. That is by using logic. So when we preach, we try to use logic also.
Right, we can. Like logic is in a way, the logic actually has a branch that this could define the art of argument. Like if one becomes an expert in logic, you know, he can argue with people in a very, very skillful way and defeat them very easily, provided the other person knows or accepts that principle.
When we refer to discussion between sages in India that would last, like for instance Chaitanya Mahaprabhu hearing from Sarvabhava Bhattacharya, we refer to those kind of discussions where logic would be the base of a common discussion, rather than
argument. Yeah, that's true.
Because we never have this experience of using a very well thought procedure in our discussion with people. First, because even if we defeat them, they won't change.
That's right.
But I just mean we are never very systematic in our approach. We're most on inspiration and on logic.
And also, the most of the people they do not, as you said, like even if they're defeated, they do not want to accept. Like in the Vedic time, there was a law, that whoever is defeated by whom, he must accept him and his conclusion as the right conclusion. And these are all actually the influence of Kali Yuga. Like those, ultimately nowadays what happens, if one is defeated by logic, then they start hurling abuses, right? And that's how you see they, you know, create a chaos. It's like, you know, a football, in a football game, when sometimes it happens, like the losing party, losing side, starts a fight, and the game is dismissed before time, so it's drawn. Right? So, I mean, these are all unfair means that people are using. Actually, logic can be a very, very sound system for analyzing, you know, what is the final, ultimate truth. The way they analyze, like, let's consider, what's the cause of suffering? And they are, you know, like, I mean, you have to be very, very systematic to figure these things out. You know? Like, we are just giving their conclusion, but, you know, when they have to derive the conclusion themselves, it's not an easy job, you know, to figure out that the body is the cause of suffering, the senses and objects of senses and so on and so forth.
The reason why they were studying, the Mayavadi sannyasis were studying Vedanta Sutras so long, I don't know, I mean, at least for myself, when reading the sutras, actually, what is what we would call the logic is not appearing actually, because I feel like it's like a code.
It's
an
unfair application of the logic. And it can, one, we can also consider, you know, Shankaracharya, at that time, you know, like Shankaracharya didn't have any other means. Like to defeat the Buddhists, you know, he had to use that technique. Like, it's not that Shankaracharya used distorted version of the logic or distorted application of the argument in order to confuse people from the Vedic knowledge. He did that in order to defeat the Buddhists. Right? Because at that time, India was completely taken over by the Buddhists. And Shankaracharya had to establish the Vedas. So he used the logic in order to defeat the Buddhists, because they would not listen to the Vedic conclusion. Right? They would not take the theistic conclusion. So he had to defeat the atheistic conclusion with the Vedic logic. And finally, actually, sometimes, you know, when people would not even listen to the logic argument. So for them, Shankaracharya had those Naga sannyasis and gave them a stick. And the people, those who would not listen to logic, he would beat them up and drive them out. That's how he drove the Mayavadi, the Buddhists out of India.
He had this, what, the Naga sannyasis, like a SS or
something? Yeah, they had the gundas actually. Yeah. And they're powerful. They had, you know, yoga, some kind of yoga siddhi. And he used them. Shankaracharya started with Naga sampradaya. And he started that sampradaya only to break the hard knots. Yeah, Puna Tattva.
Yeah. Well, if you're in the 87 year, the people less along in the 87 year has lost really their belief.
Must be. As I mentioned, that the number of your breath is constant. Now it depends how slowly or how fast you breathe, and accordingly becomes your lifespan.
Then people have all the yoga.
They are so pure that they didn't have to practice it as separately. Like even we see, like some people, they actually breathe only 40 breaths a minute. Some people breathe only 40 breaths a minute, whereas the average is about 70. Normal person breathes 70. But a person who takes 40 breaths, you know, what kind of people? These Olympic champions, you know, these athletes. Their breath is sometimes 35, 40. And that shows, you know, how much energy they have. And that's why they have that extra energy to push the body, you know.
They don't live longer.
They
don't live longer.
They don't?
They live longer.
Because they waste it up.
Is it?
They exert themselves so much, you know, practicing, and they practice for 8-10 hours every day. So they have been gifted with some, you know, blessings. They have been gifted with some, you know, wonderful facilities. But they are waste squandering it. Just to have an, you know, piece of silver cup.
You said also that by the professing of the creed, then people are more protected from the material objects.
No, I meant that when one becomes materially attached, then he becomes agitated. And more one becomes agitated, faster becomes his breathing. Ultimately, of course, it is like that. Ultimately, it's both are linked up, karma and action and reaction. Then the reaction is producing action. Then it's going on like that in cyclic order, action-reaction principle. And that's to say a person who is taking, say, 30 breaths or say 35 breaths a minute, probably he was basically, he's a very detached person, in a peaceful person. But he has been, you know, forced into, you know, breathe faster. And then, you know, he gradually becomes more and more attached to the material nature. Actually, materially successful people also are endowed with great, you know, spiritual gifts. Even all, practically most of these materially very, very successful are prominent persons. Spiritually also could have been very advanced if they were directed properly. And that's why those who are practicing spiritual life now, in future they all will be very, very, very much blessed with many good qualities. Now, if they do not utilize those qualities properly, then they will fall down again. Like one thing you will notice, that the poets or great philosophers, they have such a penetrating vision. Now that doesn't come from nothing, that doesn't come from practice. Right? That comes from the sukriti of the previous birth. Yeah, Vasudev?
In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, surrender all, abandon all kinds of living, using, mean all the different steps, and just surrender to me, like, just
give Uttara Mimamsa. Yeah, right. He says, give up all karmakanda section, karmakanda practices and jnanakanda practices. And simply come to the upasana kanda, or pure devotional service. I'll take his question.
Philosophy is that by just following Bhakti Yoga and all these difficulties, because you come in contact with Krishna, by Bhakti Yoga and all these difficulties, ultimately also get.
Yeah, like we have found it. We never separately studied all the different branches of philosophy. But just by being a devotee of Krishna, all this knowledge has become clear to us. I mean, otherwise can you imagine how many years it takes to understand these concepts, you know, gradually rising from one to the other. But since we are making going from higher to lower direction, from Krishna consciousness platform, we are trying to analyze the material branches of knowledge, it becomes very easily understandable.
That is that this coming contact with Krishna consciousness is because of mercy to spiritual master, or is it some karma?
Well, that is Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Bij. In this age, none of us are qualified or is qualified. In this age, none of us is qualified. It's only by the mercy, causeless mercy of Krishna and the spiritual master that we have.
Why I'm accepting you, by not anybody else, someone else is not accepting.
Yeah, because the mercy is flowing, but they are not receiving it. They don't want to receive it.
Is it not like karma?
Anyway, you can go in riddles, you know, like that.
Yeah.
Whether the egg came first or the chicken came first, you know. Yes, my three rishi. What's that? No, the worship of demigod comes in the karmakanda section. Because, worshipping of demigod is for some material benefit. But the actual Upasana Kanda is the Upasana of Vishnu or Krishna.
Concerning the first question about the origin of Sadarshana, when it's presented by many karmas, the Sadarshana ends up with Vedanta with Vaishnava philosophy.
Yeah.
So is that a recent distortion?
Yeah. Because the Vedanta, real Vedanta, was given by Vasudeva. And Vasudeva wrote the commentary to the Vedanta, and that's Srimad Bhagavatam. So actual Uttar Mimamsa is Srimad Bhagavatam. Vedanta and the explanation is in Srimad Bhagavatam. Whereas Shankaracharya distorted the Vedanta.
So it is since Shankaracharya that Sadarshana has been ending in Vedanta, or has been presented?
No, it was ending in Vedanta, but Shankaracharya gave a distorted meaning of the Vedanta. That's what caused the Vedanta has been accepted as the ultimate, you know, Uttar Mimamsa. Mother Tarunamrita.
You said that the soul is in the air, on the air?
In the body, yeah.
In the body. And then you said it was imbalance when the soul is going to the situation, and that's how the soul becomes attached to the body.
Matter. It's a. You see, when you are very peaceful, or when you become detached, how do you feel? You feel peaceful, right? But when you feel attached, how do you feel? You feel agitated, right? Consider a person who is very attached, and consider his mind. How it will be? Will it be very peaceful? Can you think of an attached person in a peaceful state of mind? Externally, he may appear to be calm and composed, but he cannot be peaceful. In order to become peaceful, one has to become detached. Consider what is Krishna's peace formula. Bhoktaram yogya tapasam sarvaloko maheshwaram shuridam sarvabhutanam gyatva mam shantim ricchati. Now what does that mean? Understanding Krishna as the supreme enjoyer. And he is the supreme controller. And he is our dearmost friend. So when you come to that understanding that the supreme proprietor of this universe is our friend, then how will you feel? You feel completely dependent on Krishna. Right? And that kind of dependence actually gives us the sense of attachment, detachment. And that's what gives us the peace. But you know, consider a person who tries to make all kinds of arrangements himself. Oh, what will happen to my son? What will happen to my daughter? Oh, she is going to school. Maybe some car came and ran over her. Or, you know, like always, you know, in anxiety. So attachment actually causes anxiety. And more anxious you become, the faster you breathe.
Yeah. And you speak about self-awareness and yes, sound and all the subspace and rejecting the human self-awareness. I just want to accept about Visamdeva. He is stating that higher than the human form, the human body is the ghost body, higher than the ghost body is the demigod body. I don't see exactly how a ghost body is more fit than the human body.
Yeah. The higher in the sense more subtle. Not higher. Actually, if you consider in a spiritual understanding, then the human body is the highest form. It's even better than the demigod's body. Right? Because if your goal is to become Krishna conscious, then the human form is the best. Right? But consider what is a ghost body. Ghost body is a body that has the subtle body and a very strong attachment to the material nature. So that body, you know, is subtle. So it's finer and it can actually perform wonderful things. But a demigod body, now the ghost body is material, although they are in a subtle body, in a more finer body, but still they are very much attached to the material nature. Whereas the demigods, they are less attached and they are connected to Krishna through their devotion, whereas the ghosts are not.
So that's mainly material calculation.
From the material calculation. False ego is actually a subtle matter. False ego, ultimately, of course, it's related to the air. But the false ego is the subtlest of all matters that bewilders our identity. That's the false ego. And it is due to a false ego that we become involved in this 5 years. If we are not, then we wouldn't become involved. Like a person who is free from his false ego, he is free from this material body. What to talk about his, you know, any kind of attachment in this material nature, subtle or gross. Yeah. That's why ultimately it is surrender. And by this surrender, the false ego is transformed into real identity. And our false ego means our revolt, right? Our denial of Krishna. Trying to become the Lord ourselves. But when we give up that concept and become Krishna's eternal servant, then at that point, the false ego is destroyed. Or one becomes free from the bondage of false ego.
Could this be the last question?
Okay. Yes. Oh, I see. Yeah, right. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just wondering if you said it's enough to, just, you were saying it's enough to,
yeah.
So this attachment will come from, you know, education comes from attachment. Because when one is not attached to the evidence, it's Krishna, then we have the value, which means that it looks like it, that the possible attachment to the value is only the original possible.
Yeah, ultimately, of course, it's due to the false ego that one becomes attached. But these are all mechanical processes for... No, it's not enough. Ultimately, the yogis, if they are not... Ultimately, if they don't surrender to Krishna, they cannot become free from material bondage. Actually, otherwise, it actually acts the other way around. It inflates one's false ego. If the yogi ultimately doesn't become surrendered to Krishna, then he would try to merge into Brahma, right? And that is the, you know, ultimate, you know, expansion of false ego. That I am Brahma, I am everything, I am the supreme controller, right? So that's why through these processes, if they are not directed properly, there is a chance, great chance, of becoming totally misleading.
Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna.
So, before everyone leaves, I'd like to again explain the program of this afternoon.